Hey, welcome to Helmet, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Devin.
And we're back on a Thursday.
On a Thursday, as always.
How's your week been?
It's been okay.
Yeah.
It's been okay. I mean, there's been a deluge of bullshit, as always.
Yeah. I mean, perma block, evergreen. Yeah, my week has been full of watching The Keepers.
Oh.
Which is the Netflix
show. Oh, good.
It's really good. And I don't want to give away any spoilers, but it's essentially about a group of women who are looking into a cold case of the murder of one of their teachers, who was a nun,
right.
Sister Kathy. And it's fascinating.
Yeah. And they, you know, as they're looking into the murder, they just started with the murder, but it kind of becomes this, like, whole thing about she had information on child abuse in the church.
Yeah, it'll make you really, really upset about organized religion, especially
yes.
the Catholic Church.
Yes, it will.
And this was like kind of in the when this murder happened, when this abuse was happening, it was sort of pre-spotlight.
Yes.
But yeah, it is a fascinating show, and it's interesting because Devin said she hasn't finished it.
I
don't want to spoil it for anyone. But we were sort of talking about on the last podcast, is there a crossover between, you know, people who listen to us and My Favorite Murder? And we got a lot of tweets from people who are like, I listen to My Favorite Murder too. Like,
yeah.
There's something going on with women and like
yeah.
That we just love true crime.
True
I don't know what it is about it. We sort of talked about it
yeah.
the other day. Like, that it's almost like...
Well, the way I put it is, right after I had my son,
yes.
I had these horrible, vivid dreams of horrible things happening to him.
Right.
And so... And it would freak me out. And so I asked my doctor about it. And she was like, that's really common after you have a kid because your subconscious is working out your worst fears, like at night, to protect you from them.
Gotcha.
And so I think it's the same thing. Like, I think a lot of women love the true crime because you're like working out some of your deeper fears.
Yeah. It's something that is so always sort of running in the back of our minds.
Right.
Like a possibility. And it's almost... like a release to watch stuff.
Yes.
Because you're working out your biggest fears.
Right.
So there's an interesting dynamic and relationship between women and true crime. But anyway, watch the show.
It's so good.
Phenomenal.
So good.
Devin, let's switch back to politics since this is what our fucking podcast
what we do.
Is about. You want to go through what we're going to be discussing today?
Yes. First, we're going to be getting into our listener feedback and general updates, as always. And then the second block is Trump land bullshit, so evergreen.
Yeah.
And then next, we have another interview.
Yeah, we're really excited about this one. It's my friend Julie Belutis. She's a longtime Democratic volunteer organizer, strategist, and just all around passionate advocate for local politics. She's an alumnus of many campaigns, so we're
yes.
going to be delving deep into the Virginia governor's race because the primary is on June 13th for the Democrats.
She's so interesting. It's going to be great. And then we go into our gratitude check, you know, so necessary.
Always needed.
Always. And then we have the Maxine Waters update and the Maxine Waters award in badassery. So lots of good things to talk about there. And then finally, we've got action items. So something that you can do after you are done listening. Okay, Sarah, so let's get into some listener feedback and updates. So what do you got first?
Yeah, it's funny. The last podcast, we didn't really have that much feedback.
We didn't.
This podcast just, you know, ripped right back at us. And we got lots of feedback, which
we
is
did.
Great. We always love feedback.
Love feedback.
The first thing, which is probably one of my favorite things that I've ever heard. So Clara said in the Facebook group, she was recounting... a story, like she, you know, that involves her. So she said, I was telling a friend about Hellbent while in line at the grocery store when the lady behind me says, I'm sorry, I don't mean to eavesdrop, but are you talking about Sarah and Devin? And I was like, yeah. And then she said, oh, I love them. And then I said, oh my God, I know, right? I want them to do a Hellbent tour and come to Canada. Yes. And then the hashtag was hashtag buying kale and calling out dickwads, which is just my favorite
I
thing.
Know.
Also, like, just bless Canada.
Bless Canada.
I mean, like, we're, you know, a little podcast that could.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just, it kind of is amazing that in a line in, you know, in Canada, somewhere in Canada, there's two... couple women connecting about Hellbent. That just like warms my cold dead heart.
Me too. I was just gonna say the black depths of my soul.
Yeah, and you know, when we are able to, like eventually we would love to go on tour. That's
mm-hmm.
like that's down the line though.
Like that's like goals.
Yeah,
man.
That's goals. So but thank you for sharing that, Clara. That definitely brought a smile to both of our faces.
Yes.
Okay, so what else, Devin?
Well, so Josie tweeted at us, said, hey Hellbent Pod, noticed you pronounce Angela Merkel's first name like in Spanish. In German, it has a hard G, like in quote, guys.
Yeah, I actually Googled the, how to pronounce the name, and it's like Angela.
Angela.
Angela Merkel.
Okay, so not Angela, not Angela.
I believe it's Angela.
Angela.
But Josie, please tell us if we are wrong again.
Yeah, please.
we're committed to this.
Yeah.
Jenny also reached out, and she said, quote, love the podcast a lot, but am I crazy, or did you say in episode 32 that Germany and Russia were allies in World War II? Before Devin gets into this, just note, we try not to say the word crazy, but we're just quoting.
Yeah, and we also, it's hard. We get it.
Yeah.
You know, we are, it's a process.
Yeah, so it is a process.
No worries.
But Devin, why don't you address this little modification?
Right. So I did say that, and I was wrong. So I mixed up what I thought was an alliance treaty that was signed in 1939 between Russia and Germany with what was the Russian-German non-aggression pact of 1939.
Yeah, so slightly different.
Slightly different. There was never an alliance. And in fact, Russia was allied with the West for most of the war and was a major player in the Eastern European theaters. The non-aggression pact was signed just before World War II and stated that Russia and Germany would not engage in acts of war for 10 years. There was also some secret language about how the two countries would like divide up Eastern Europe at the end of the pact. So it was kind of a little shady.
A little messy.
It fell apart 2 years later in 1941 after Germany invaded the then Soviet Union. And then Stalin joined forces with the US and the UK. And again, I'm so sorry. I reached out to my 11th grade AP US history teacher.
Yeah, because didn't he tweet at us?
He did.
I was like, I didn't realize that was him.
Yeah, Mr. King, who is the best teacher of all time, and for some clarification, and he forgave me.
Yeah, you were like, I'm so sorry. Did I fail you? And he was like, it's okay.
It's fine.
Yeah, so, you know, sometimes we get our facts wrong. We don't want them to be alternative facts, so we appreciate when you call us out, because we want to be honest about this.
Absolutely.
Like, this is something that's really important.
Absolutely.
But we're human. We make mistakes, and we appreciate the people who call us out for it. Jen also had an interesting bit of feedback. She was responding to the story about the man who was sentenced to 10 years in prison because his probation got revoked, and like just how bananas that whole thing was. She said, quote, as a lawyer, I wanted to offer some insight into your story about the judge who sentenced that guy to 10 years in prison on his probation case, even though a jury acquitted him in his new case. The standard of proof required to find someone guilty of a crime is the highest standard in law, beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard of proof required to revoke someone's probation is much, much lower. Preponderance of the evidence. Oh. Preponderance of the evidence means, quote, more likely than not. So a jury can find that the people did not prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and a judge can still determine it was more likely than not he committed the new offense because the burden of proof is so much lower. In practice, this almost never happens. She says, at least not in San Diego, which I guess is where she practices law. She said, this almost never happens because a judge usually gives due deference to the jury's decision. And even though the burden of proof to revoke the probation is lower, judges usually won't find a violation of probation if the jury acquits on the new crime. So this is really interesting insight.
I had no idea on any of that.
Yeah, so thank you, Jen. But it's definitely, for me, it further underscores how fucked up this decision was because
right.
it happened so rarely.
Yes.
Like, why in this case?
Right.
It's hard for me not to see racial bias there.
Absolutely.
But really, really interesting legal understanding there.
Yes.
So, God, we have such smart listeners.
We do. It's so cool.
It's very cool.
And then we just want to remind you that we have a Facebook group, and it is awesome.
Yeah, speaking of our smart and amazing listeners, it's called Dickwads Be Gone, a Hellbent Podcast fan group, and I love it. It's the best.
It is.
So come join us if you're so inclined.
Yeah.
It's a closed group, so you have to. We moderate people in. Sometimes I think I think we err on the side of being conservative. If we don't see a lot of publicly available information in someone's profile, then we usually don't. Approve, but if that happens to you, you can always email us and we can get that sorted. But we love the group and
we
love everyone in it. So please come join us. It's really fun. And then finally, since it is the beginning of June, we want to shout out to our $10 Patreon contributors for May. So if you can contribute $10 or more to us on Patreon, we give you a shout out at the end of the month on the podcast. So thank you, Martika Seddon,
Ruby Booth,
Gary Hoggett,
Christina Bachman,
Kenya Barber,
Janice Elliott,
Lindsay Smith,
Melina Davidson.
It's actually Melina Davidson,
Melina.
And I know that because she's my cousin.
Oh, Okay.
Thank you, Milena. Trista Turley.
And Lexi Huss.
Yeah. So thank you, everyone. And thanks to the folks who are just contributing what they can.
At all,
even
yeah.
$1 a month is hugely helpful.
It is.
I mean, we joke about, you know, Sarah's Lyft fund, but it really does
it
help.
Does help.
Yeah, in LA, you know, it really helps. So thank you to everyone who's supporting us on Patreon. And thanks again just for listening.
Yes. And if you go to hellbentpodcast.com/support, you can see the list of everyone who contributed $10 or more and other ways to get involved. All right, Sarah, so let's get into our evergreen block.
Trump <It's> back. we said it was a permablock, and then we replaced it with a couple of other branding titles.
But it is back.
It's back, because it's a permablock.
It is Trump land bullshit.
Yeah, and there's a whole hodgepodge of things. So we're going to talk about some things sort of on the domestic side. So the attack on sort of civil rights agencies or efforts within agencies, attacks on women. What else is fucking new? And then we're going to get into a Russia update because there's a lot going on there. So first, let's start with the Trump administration and sort of gutting these civil rights efforts across agencies. So we learned that the Trump administration is planning to disband this Labor Department division that has policed discrimination among federal contractors for 4 decades. It's called the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, and it will now fold into the EEOC.
Cool.
Yeah. And when we say cool, we mean not fucking cool.
Not fucking cool.
Like Trump asked, what do you have to lose? It turns out, like, fucking everything.
Everything.
Yeah. So this proposal to dismantle the compliance office comes at a time when the Trump administration is reducing the role of the federal government in fighting discrimination and protecting minorities. So I think we want to go through a few examples to remind everyone what has already happened. So what's the first thing?
Well, so the EPA leadership has already proposed eliminating its environmental justice program, which addresses pollution that poses health threats specifically concentrated in minority communities. You know, this is sort of like the NIMBY stuff, not in my backyard.
Oh, I've never heard that before.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of times like wealthy communities will be like, you can't put that here, it's my backyard. And so it gets moved.
Like Sierra Blanca.
Yes.
Within, like, Bernie Sanders, I think Vermont sent environmental waste to a different state.
Yes.
In a poorer community.
Exactly.
Poorer Latino community.
And so the EPA leadership is trying to get rid of the program that basically
addresses those kind of things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's that has already happened, the Education Department's Office of Civil Rights, which investigates thousands of complaints of discrimination in school districts across the country and also sets new standards for how colleges should respond to allegations of sexual assault and harassment. They would also face significant staffing cuts. And remember that Candace Jackson, who heads up the Civil Rights Office in the Education Department, once said she faced discrimination for being white.
What a dickwad.
So these are the kind of people that are already in place.
Right.
Who are in leadership, and they're also going to cut staff. So that's great.
Cool. Not cool. HUD, so Housing and Urban Development, has revoked the guidance to implement a rule that lets transgender people choose the sex-segregated shelters that mm-hmm. they stay in.
Mm-hmm.
So how they their gender identity matches the sex-segregated facility that they would stay at.
But you're saying HUD has revoked this
revoked
guidance.
Revoked it.
So, mm-hmm. again, yeah, another thing. And then the last thing, the Department of Health and Human Services has removed a question about sexual orientation from 2 surveys of elderly Americans about services offered or funded by the government. And again, we've sort of talked about this with the census.
Right.
Like, if you don't collect this data, you're not really going to serve those communities properly.
Yeah. Government relies on data.
Mm-hmm.
So, the former acting head of the DOJ civil rights division, Vinita Gupta.
Division.
What did I say?
Decision.
Damn it. I'm just all over the place today. She said, make no mistake, this is a rollback on civil rights across the board.
Yeah. So these are stories not to sleep on.
Right.
And when we talk about, like, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, these are the kind of stories that, you know, that we feel like are equally important to talk about, as well as healthcare, as well as Russia, as well as all this stuff. So keep your eye on this and be vigilant. So speaking of attacks on our rights, the Trump administration is going after women again. So what's the latest?
Oh,
I know. Why is this normal?
I don't know. But there was a leaked regulation. So Trump plans to roll back Obamacare birth control mandate. Mm. So the Trump administration is preparing to overhaul Obamacare's birth control mandate, purportedly allowing any employer to seek a moral or religious exemption from the requirement. So religious houses of worship were the only employers exempted from the mandate entirely under the original ACA or under Obamacare. And then Trump's draft regulation would allow any employer to request an exemption based on this moral or religious objection.
Yeah, so it basically expands sort of the scope.
Right.
And the birth control mandate is one of 8 women's preventative health care benefits that the ACA requires health care plans to provide without any cost to the patient. And so this proposal is, the Office of Management and Budget is currently reviewing it. That's the final step before a new regulation is made official. So this rule would take effect immediately once it is published by the Trump administration.
Which is just disgusting.
Yeah, because more than 20% of women of childbearing age had to pay money out of pocket for oral contraceptives prior to this ACA mandate. And this is according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. And that shrunk to less than 4% a few years after the mandate took effect. And also, according to Kaiser, contraceptives account for between 30% and 44% of women's out-of-pocket healthcare spending. So again,
yeah,
reproductive justice is a fucking economic issue.
It's I don't understand how people decouple the two.
Mm-hmm.
This is about women's spending power.
Yeah, I mean, women's ability to plan for families,
right,
and to have their own right to their own bodies is not only like a moral issue.
No,
like, that we should have the fucking right to do what we need to do with our bodies, but it's also an economic issue.
Yeah.
And also, like, you know, making it harder for people to access contraceptives, that just is a whole other public health care crisis.
Right.
Like, it causes teenage pregnancies to go up. The, you know, like, maternal mortality, all these things.
Fetal,
like,
mortality.
Like, if you are against abortion, I don't understand how you can be against contraceptives.
Right.
Because don't you want people not to have abortions?
Right.
Enable. Like,
yeah, you can't have both.
I don't understand. Again, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance there.
And I said fetal mortality. I meant infant mortality.
Infant mortality.
Excuse me. But, like, that goes up when unintended pregnancies go up.
Yeah. So, that is something that is
awful.
Awful and scary. But the National Women's Law Center has committed to filing a lawsuit against this birth control rule. So, we do not go quietly in the night, Trump administration. No, we do not.
We will not.
Yeah.
So, okay, that was fun. I'm kidding.
And when she says fun, she means the opposite. Everything is terrible.
Everything is terrible. Let's get into our Russia update, because this is just the story that will not quit.
Like Michael Flynn.
Like Michael Flynn.
The New York City cockroach.
Just
will not go away.
Back.
Yeah, so there's a couple of big stories.
There are.
Within the last couple of days. So the first one was the Trump administration moving to return Russian compounds in Maryland and New York. So remember how, you know, Russia fucking interfered in our election? Just let you forget.
Lest we forget.
And then there were punishments for that. Well, now the Trump administration wants to undo that. So,
right. So Russia, mm-hmm, back when the sanctions were put in place.
By Obama. Like at the 11th hour of his presidency.
Right. Russia didn't respond, which normally when sanctions are put on one country, they kind of respond in kind, yeah, with their own sanctions.
People were like, huh, that's weird. Why is Russia silent?
Right. But it later emerged that Flynn, in a phone conversation with the Russian ambassador, Kislyak, had advised against retaliation and indicated that U.S. policy would change under the Trump administration.
Which seems to be coming to fruit now.
Right.
Because, now Trump has said, oh, we might give these compounds back to Russia. And,
right,
like, no, and it doesn't seem to be clear that we're getting really anything in return. This seems very quid pro quo-y.
Oh, it totally is.
I don't know
is.
If that's a word, but it definitely seems like Trump is delivering on something.
Well, I mean, it's so clear that this sort of...
Like, how could it be any more obvious?
Right?
Like, it's happening right in front of our faces.
And it's blatant.
It's so blatant.
Like, Michael Flynn talked about this happening, and then a couple of months later, it happens.
It's gonna happen.
I don't
think that they've officially done it yet.
No,
but
I'm
signaling that.
But even still,
yeah,
like,
Yeah, and so Obama, you know, when he imposed these sanctions, he said on, you know, in late December that these diplomatic compounds were being used by Russian personnel for intelligence-related purposes. And he, you know, remember, he gave them 24 hours to vacate. So he's like, get the fuck out of here. And he actually didn't even, I remember he didn't even, he gave, like, the Trump transition, like, a couple of hours notice.
Because
he was worried that they would
tell them.
Separately, Obama expelled from the United States what he said were 35 Russian intelligence operatives.
So rolling back these sanctions really looks shady, because any concessions to Moscow could really prove controversial. I mean, this administration
is under investigation.
It's under investigation.
Like, how do, like,
there's a goddamn special counsel.
This is happening right in front of our eyes. So these compounds, there's a 14-acre estate in Long Island and several buildings along the Corsica River on Maryland's eastern shore. They've been in Russian possession since the days of the Soviet Union. So this decision was not made lightly by Obama.
Right.
And Russia, I love Russia's, like, cover for this. They're like, well, they're like, these facilities are for rest and recreation for embassy and UN employees. But, like, US officials call bullshit on that. They're like, this is long believed to have been used for intelligence purposes.
Because that's just such a load of crap.
Like, they were clearly, like, you know, spy huts.
Spy huts. Well, and then creepily, the Russian embassy in the U.S. tweeted on May 22nd, quote, Russia is seeking to return its diplomatic property in the U.S. ASAP. Otherwise, we will have to take countermeasures.
Yeah, so this was tweeted like a few days or like a week or so before the story came out.
Right.
And so now you go back and look at that and you're like, what did you mean by that?
Yeah, so this is definitely not a quid pro quo.
We can't even say it.
No.
It feels very quid pro quo, but nothing to see here. Totally normal. Everything's fine. So let's move on.
Okay.
But again, put a pin in that.
Put a pin in that. We're coming back.
That's a story. So Kislyak pops up in another big Russia report this week, this time involving Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So what did we learn here, Devin?
We learned that Jeff Sessions is a bigger dickwad than we thought.
He is the biggest. We thought he was a really big dickwad.
But
he's an even bigger dickwad.
So Congress is investigating another possible Sessions-Kislyak meeting
that
we didn't know about before.
That happened even earlier.
Right.
So the two previously undisclosed meetings were in July and September. This one, the date they're looking at is April 27th, 2016.
Right. In the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C., where then-candidate Trump was delivering his first major policy address, which I'm assuming was just
major
blank.
Foreign policy address.
Right. Yeah. Foreign policy address, which I'm assuming was just blank because he has none.
No, I think people were like definitely like looking at it, like side-eyeing it.
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, you're like tipping your hat to Russia a little bit.
Right. Well, and then prior to the speech, then Senator Sessions and Kislyak attended a like VIP reception with organizers, diplomats, and others. And investigators have yet to conclude whether a private meeting took place and acknowledge it is possible that any additional meeting was incidental. So they're not totally sure what the larger context is.
Yeah, they're couching it a little bit because, you know, they want to verify. But there's too many coincidences that are happening with all these Russia meetings.
That's the problem. If this were the only thing, I could be like, okay.
But he's lied so many times before.
So many times. And so you have to ask, like, what is this dickwad have to do to be pushed out of office? He's already lied. He's already recused and then unrecused himself from the Russia investigation.
Essentially. Yeah.
I mean, what does he have to do?
Yeah, so just some background context, you know, just to refresh our memory. So Sessions has previously failed to disclose meetings with Russian officials. So during his confirmation hearing, he testified that he did not have any communications with the Russians during the campaign. He also said it in a written statement submitted to the Senate Judiciary Committee that he was not in contact with anyone linked to the Russian government during the election. He also admitted these meetings from his security clearance forms. And remember, he corrected his initial Senate confirmation hearing testimony, but then didn't include this possible meeting.
Right.
So if this is coming up, we know for sure he is fucking lying out of his ass.
Over and over and over.
It's already pretty obvious, this would be, I think, like the last straw.
Yeah.
CNN, interestingly, also reported recently that Senator Leahy and Senator Franken, so both Democrats, they sent letters to the FBI in March, April, and May asking then FBI Director James Comey to investigate Sessions for possible perjury.
Well, good, because he fucking committed perjury. I mean, I don't understand why this is so, like,
literally lied under oath.
Yeah.
And then I don't think they got any letters back.
Probably not.
So, but now, this is interesting, because if this is true, this, I think, heats up the investigation even more.
Yeah.
Because then this morning, again, we cannot keep up with news. I'm constantly updating our outline because I'm like, more shit has come down. So NBC News added to this CNN reporting this morning. They are saying that five current and former U.S. officials said that they are aware of classified intelligence suggesting that there was some sort of private encounter between Trump, Sessions, Kushner, and Kislyak. Right. And this goes back to that April date.
Right.
When he was a candidate, when he gave a speech at the Mayflower. Like, beyond this sort of small VIP reception, they're saying that it's quite possible that there was a private meeting between the four of them.
Well, and that is also particularly interesting because a lot of this Russia collusion stuff has talked about people close to Trump, people around Trump, people in the Trump campaign.
Right.
But this is the first time that they've really connected it to Trump himself.
Yeah, like, now it has officially reached Trump.
Right.
Like, because, like you said, a lot of it was, like, aides talking with Russian officials.
Right.
Now there's a question of whether Trump has participated. I mean, which I think... The fish rots from the head. So I think this is only the beginning of the story. I think we're going to find out more. I mean,
like... Watergate took 900 days. Yeah. We are on day 133. We are going to get this.
Oh, my God. Yeah, as Rachel said, she's like, we're going to get this.
We will
this
fight.
Is the bad week for Rachel Maddow to be sick.
I know.
I'm like, can you come back?
Come back.
She came back last Thursday.
Yeah, because like
she was like, and she was really sick. She's like, I am loopy.
Yeah,
she's like, go home, Rachel. And she's like, been sick for the last week. I'm like, this is such a strange week for her to be sick.
I know.
So please come back, Rachel, and get better. So some other bits and nibbles around the Russia investigation, because again, there's still so much shit. So Russians discuss potentially derogatory information about Trump and associates during the campaign. In conversations that were intercepted by U.S. intelligence during the election. So this information was financial in nature as well. So there were basically communications intercepted that sounded like they could try to like influence Trump because they might have leverage.
Interesting.
Derogatory, you know, potentially derogatory information.
I wonder if
slash
it was
the Pete Davidson.
I was going to say, I wonder if it was financials about him paying for prostitutes to pee on him.
Potentially.
Potentially.
The Russia investigation has also expanded to include Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. He's the says who guy.
Right. Says who?
The Pulse, all of them.
Says who?
The investigation is also looking into the Kush's motives in meeting with Gorkov. So he is the head of VEB, which is the bank, and Gorkov is believed to be a Russian spy.
And one of the New York CEO of VEB just got out of prison for fucking treason.
Right, we just talked about that. I remember
so
that.
So, fuck yeah. That. The House Intelligence Committee has issued subpoenas to both Cohen and Flynn. This is among seven subpoenas that the committee has issued.
Mm-hmm.
And separately, Flynn said that he would provide some documents under subpoena to the Senate Intelligence Panel.
Yeah, so that's going to be interesting.
That's going to be interesting. Also, I'm excited because this is what excites me now. James Comey plans to testify publicly in the Senate on June 8th, which is next week.
Yeah, so it's next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
Or next Thursday, excuse me.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the Wall Street Journal reports that Comey will say Trump asked him to back off the Flynn probe in this kind of testimony before the Senate.
My body is ready.
I am pumped.
My popcorn is already popped. Right. It's going to be a little stale.
It's good. But it's going to be good.
I am ready for that testimony. Also, our queen. Hillary Clinton, she was at a Recode conference yesterday. She talked a lot about like hacking.
Right.
Because it's a technology conference. So she said something really interesting. She said that Russian hackers were not versed enough in U.S. politics to sway it in 2016 alone. So she said, quote, unless they had been guided by Americans. And the two people asking her those questions were like, what do you mean? Like, are you leaning toward like Team mm-hmm. Trump? And she was like, I'm leaning there. So she basically implied that the Trump camp was likely involved.
Right.
Like, that there was some coordination, which, listen, she's been fucking right about everything.
Everything.
So I would put money on that.
She's bringing the motherfucking fire these days.
But she, you know, she did make a good point, you know, when that sort of grab him by the pussy tape came out. Within hours, it was another Podesta email dump.
Well, so that's the thing. That's
they weaponized that.
They weaponized that narrative because every time Trump had a bad day, that's when they would release
WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm. That's when it would come out. So, yeah, it was obviously guided by, like,
some... There was some coordination. There had to be some coordination.
Yeah.
Again, this isn't verified.
No.
But this is where it feels like it's leading
toward. Right, and when you think through it, you know, this
sense.
Is... Yeah. And then the New York Post, this is really scary. I hate this.
Yeah.
Reports that the... Department of Justice has granted warrants to conduct surveillance on certain journalists to find leakers.
Yes, they actually got a FISA warrant.
Yeah. So the target is the leakers, not the journalists, but... Look.
This is really chilling.
Free press is absolutely essential to democracy. I don't know how many times I can say it, yeah. But I will keep saying it.
Yeah.
And this is just an erosion, mm-hmm. a slow mm-hmm. erosion of that free press.
Yeah. And, you know, the Trump camp is really focused on leakers.
Right.
But, I mean, pretty much the reason why we know all this stuff and we have a special counsel and all this stuff is because of the stories that have come out.
Yes.
Because of sources, because of good reporting. So
if Trump doesn't want leakers, he should call Beyonce and be like, how did you keep Lemonade a secret for a goddamn year?
Also, like, P.S. Trump loved leakers when it was
right
concerning Hillary Clinton. And if the pee tape is true, he loves leakers. So we're really excited to talk to our next guest.
Yes.
Julie Balutis is a technology consultant and longtime Democratic volunteer organizer, strategist, and passionate advocate for local politics and volunteerism. She's moonlighted on 3 presidential, 4 gubernatorial, 8 Senate, 16 House races, and too many local campaigns to count. These days, she's working hard to keep Virginia's governor's mansion blue and flip as many state House seats as possible this November. She also has one of our favorite bios on Twitter, which reads, Arab American, feminist, Democrat, Putin-free diet, not unpleasant, just alt nice. Among, not in, the bushes. It's such a great Twitter bio. It's welcome, so Julie. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you. I think this is a really exciting time in Virginia, and I'm really excited to talk to y'all about it.
Yeah, we're super, super stoked to talk about Virginia, because Virginia, the governor's race is coming right up, and there's a lot of interesting mm-hmm. things happening there. But first, you know, it's day 133 of Trump's America. Just how, in general, are you feeling?
Oh, goodness. You know,
it's that, a loaded
the
question.
How are you doing question? I know. It used to be good meant good, and now it's like good means eh, but it could be a lot worse. It could be a lot better. Mm-hmm. We are obviously in a better place than a lot of people, so trying to keep that in perspective every day and one foot in front of the other, pants on, one leg at a time, all of that.
Yeah, win some local and state races, which is what we'll be talking to you. Let's jump right in. So the Democratic primary for the Virginia governor's race is on June 13th, so it's coming right up. Ralph Northam is seen as the quote-unquote establishment candidate, and Tom Perriello is being branded as the quote-unquote unabashed liberal. Do you feel like that's a fair characterization, or is it more nuanced than that?
There's definitely some parallels, but it's always more nuanced than what the national narrative kind of makes of it, right? So the national media has kind of been making this into yet another rehashing of Hillary and Bernie, which is just awesome because we were all really excited to relive that again. And it's probably in large part because of Bernie's endorsement of Perriello. But overall, I would say that characterization is somewhat of a square peg in a round hole. And again, I'm really glad of that because we are all really done fighting that fight.
Yeah.
There are definitely elements of the pragmatist versus the populist in the race in terms of branding, but I think the race is less about establishment versus outsider than it is about national versus local Democrats. In my view, both candidates are establishment. Northam is very deeply entrenched in our state politics, and Perriello is very much a part of the national Democratic apparatus. Northam was a state senator for 6 years. He became our lieutenant governor in 2013, so he's about 10 years into his service in Virginia. He's got a lot of relationships with state and local politicians and with constituents. So he's got the endorsements and support of our Virginia Party, quote unquote, establishment. You know, Terry McAuliffe, the governor, Senators Kane and Warner, 3 Democratic congressional reps, and something like 70 or more of our Dems in the state legislature. So that gets him the establishment label, which, you know, I would argue it's become kind of a bad word. But it isn't always necessarily. Sometimes it just means experienced, and it's hard not to conflate the two in terms of what's good and what's bad and what's better for leadership in a state.
Yeah, I always felt like establishment, like, I mean, not to go back to the 2016 election.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say.
But I'm like, it's funny how establishment became sort of a pejorative after we had a black president and, like, a female presidential nominee. It is really strange. Right. Why is that such a bad thing, or necessarily?
And then also in the 2016 campaign, they managed to make experience a bad thing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
This person is too experienced.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, what is that?
Yeah, but it sounds like what you're saying is that it is a lot more nuanced than that sort of, like, diametrically opposed or seemingly diametrically opposing comparison.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, Perriello, I mean, he's held elected office once. He had one term as a congressman in the Charlottesville area, which is a pretty conservative area of Virginia. UVA is there, but the surrounding district is kind of farmland and a lot more conservative than, you know, what would you think we would normally think of as a college town. He lost his seat in 2010 after voting yes on the Affordable Care Act. There's some nuance to that too, but he did lose his seat in that that Tea Party wave of 2010. And after that, he went to the Center for American Progress, which obviously is very much associated with the political establishment that's, you know, formerly headed by John Podesta, now headed by Neera Tanden. A lot of people associate it with the Clintons and sort of the Democratic status quo. So they're not the status quo. They do so much good work, and they do amazing things there, but they're definitely considered quote-unquote national establishment. After that, he joined the Obama administration as a special envoy in Africa. So both carry sort of a bag of establishment credentials, but it depends on which establishment we're talking about.
So it basically boils down to who's endorsed who. So Perriello gets, you know, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and interestingly enough, John Podesta as well, because that Center of American Progress connection. Who is favored to win in this race?
Oh my goodness, it is anyone's guess right now. Primary polling in state races is weird. Not a lot of money is always spent on it, and you don't necessarily know how accurate it is. So I've seen polls where they're neck and neck, and polls where Perriello has an edge, and polls where Northam is significantly ahead. I don't know that I would rely on any of those necessarily. I think we're going to be in for a very close race on June 13th.
Yeah, super interesting.
So Perriello's history with abortion rights is a little bit murky. In 2009, he backed the Stupak-Pitts Amendment in the Affordable Care Act, which put obstacles in the way for private insurance coverage of abortion. He has now called it the, quote, worst vote of my career. So how does Perriello's pro-choice stance and record compare to Northam's?
Yeah, murky is a pretty good way to put it. The Stupak vote. I'm glad he's acknowledged that it was a terrible vote. What I appreciate a little bit less is the timing of that apology, which came after he announced his candidacy for the governor's race. So it's a pretty long gap, right? It's 7 years between that vote and the apology for it. And he's saying all the right things about, you know, reproductive rights now, but it's revealing to me that he didn't say them until it became apparent that it would be politically expedient to do so, and also that he was kind of willing to sell out reproductive rights in the first place when that was politically expedient. As far as Northam's record, there's really not a whole lot of... I mean, he's been an absolute champion on women's rights and reproductive freedom. He has fought a ton of awful, awful anti-choice legislation in Richmond. Our state house has come up with some very creative ways of trying to fuck women over in terms of our right to choose. Some of it has succeeded because it is, you know, at the state level, somewhat of a red state, and has been for a long time. And the advocacy work that's being done by NARAL Virginia and people here to fight that has been huge. And Ralph Northam has stood alongside them. He played a key role in defeating a really, really, really bad transvaginal ultrasound bill. His knowledge as a doctor and his vehemence in speaking out against it, including, you know, using the word transvaginal on the House floor, which a lot of people, you know, they'll try to frame it as like, oh, well, you know, it's just a little procedure, a little jelly on the belly. And
he
kind of famously held up a Gatorade bottle and was like, well, you might as well just put some, you know, an ultrasound wand on here. And it was great.
Wow.
I mean, he's just a passionate advocate for choice, and he's endorsed by NARAL Virginia, and like I mentioned, they've spent years doing the work in Richmond, and they really trust him and stand alongside him.
Yeah, I think I saw something the other day that I don't remember, so correct me if I'm wrong, Northam is sort of planning to fight this birth control attack that the Trump administration within Virginia. He said that's something he would fight.
What he wants to do, we have a law that passed a few months ago that mandates that women get a year of, that insurance companies cover a year of birth control for women, and he wants to codify that into state law so that insurance companies are still bound to that in Virginia without having to, you know, comply with this Trump attack on women.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. So just to be a little bit fair-ish to Perriello, or to try to see sort of his side, how would you contextualize his quote-unquote evolution on choice compared to, say, Tim Kaine?
I would say they're fairly similar. They've both come around over time, and, you know, as it's become more and more apparent that that's what the vast majority of Americans believe in. The vast majority of Americans support the right to choose. Y'all talked to Erica Sacken last week, and she talked about that. This is the way we're going, and this is why this advocacy work for choice is so, so important. The stuff that PP Act is doing, the stuff that NARAL does, that's how we push our politicians to evolve, even though their personal beliefs might not be as pro-choice as they want them to be, as we want them to be. When we show them that America wants women to be able to choose, they will legislate that way. So one difference I would say is that Kaine as governor held a much more powerful office than Perriello did before he really evolved on choice, and actually passed some pretty crappy anti-choice bills while he was in office. I can't say how Perriello would have voted on abortion rights had he won re-election. I don't really doubt that he would have stayed the course he was on in a red district. But regardless, I'm always glad to see evolution on choice, you know, even when it takes a lot longer than we want it to.
Yeah. I mean, I always say that I don't really care what a politician's personal beliefs are. You can believe whatever you want to believe as long as you're legislating for your constituents.
Absolutely.
But I think you're right, too. Like, the grassroots advocacy is what sort of moves the needle for people who, you know, even whatever they are, pro-choice, pro-life, to legislate in a pro-choice way.
Anti-choice.
Yep.
Right, anti-choice. Sorry.
It's one of my pet peeves.
Yes.
So, you know, it is also interesting because 51 of Perriello's donations come from outside of the state.
51%.
What did I say?
You said 51. That's okay.
Okay.
51%.
while 91 of Northam's come from within Virginia. So do you think something like that matters to Virginia voters?
Yeah, that's interesting. There's been a lot of talk from the Perriello campaign about he's taken a pledge to not accept money from the oil and gas industry. Dominion is a big donor here. So as a result of that, Northam's taken a lot of heat for accepting a donation from Dominion Power, which was relatively small, I think, a few thousand dollars. It honestly probably would have been better to just not take it and avoid the controversy. Because now, you know, you have to argue that he is not beholden to their interests, and he's not. You know, he took money from the tobacco industry years ago and passed the non-smoking bill in restaurants here. So he's kind of shown that he's not beholden to the interests of his donors, but at the same time, that's a lot harder of an argument to make. But it's opened an interesting dialogue that I think goes back to the discussion about kind of national versus local politics. If it's not okay to take in-state corporate donations, is it also not okay to have over half your campaign money come from, you know, wealthy, mostly out-of-state donors? I don't know. I don't have a good answer to it. It's an ongoing conversation. And also, the one thing I resent is that a lot of Perriello's money comes from Soros, and I feel like as a protester, that should be going directly into my pocket in the form of
sweet protest checks.
Yes, exactly. Where are my checks? Yes, I do not want those going to Tom Perriello. I would like them to come directly to me.
Exactly.
Like, I will route them appropriately.
If you're going to accuse me of getting sweet Soros money,
I want to get it.
Right.
Well, and I also feel like this split sort of speaks to what we were sort of referring to earlier, which is sort of like, national endorsements versus like local and state experience. So like, you know, Perriello, a lot of his donors come outside Virginia. Maybe that speaks to the Bernie Sanders type, Elizabeth Warren type endorsements. Maybe the 91% of Northam's voters coming within Virginia speaks to sort of his connections within Virginia politics. So I find that interesting. It's going to be interesting to see which one Virginia voters prefer.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just to sort of get a little more personal here, what are the reasons that you personally support Northam over Perriello?
We've covered it a lot already, I think. I mean, first for me, it's when I'm choosing a candidate, it's all about kind of having the receipts. And that's not to say that I would not vote for a candidate that didn't have a lot of experience in elected office. But if I am looking at two candidates and one, especially in a local race and a state race, and I can see that one has been doing the work in my state, and I can look back at a decade of, you know, good voting, good legislation, passionate advocacy for the issues I believe in, reproductive rights, gun control, the tobacco industry, healthcare, all of those things are really, really important to me. So when I can look back and see that one candidate has a record that I can trace and, you know, see any evolution if there's a problem, and at the very least see that he has relationships in the state and has the best interests of Virginians at heart, that is something that's very important to me. And I think we talked a little bit about using establishment as an insult these days. But the upside of it is that it gives you a clear paper trail, right? I mean, you can see how somebody's voted. You can see their legislative record. And for me, that's very simply like the best indicator of how someone will govern. And I read a really good endorsement of Northam from Andy Parker, who is the father of Allison Parker. She was a reporter who was shot on the air in Roanoke, Virginia in 2015. And he has been a passionate advocate for gun control since then. And he basically says the same thing I did. It's a record versus promises. Perriello was endorsed by the NRA when he ran. He took campaign contributions from them. He had an A rating from them. So when I look at that record versus what he says now and Northam's consistency on these issues, it's not even a question for me. And what Andy Parker said is, I'm going to dance with who brung me. And that's where I stand as well.
Perfectly stated.
Yeah.
On the flip side, what would you say the case is for Perriello? Like, what is what are some things that make him a good candidate, in your opinion?
Yeah, he has a lot of finesse and charisma. He speaks passionately about progressive issues. That's very clearly appealing to a lot of people. I also think his experience as a policy counselor at CAP has given him a lot of in-depth policy experience and knowledge, which, you know, on everything from voting rights to campaign finance reform, which would be very valuable as a governor. I mean, I'll be really clear. Though I don't support him in the primary, I would obviously be 100% behind him should it come to that against the Republican and the general. It's just too important to keep a Democrat in our governor's mansion.
Definitely.
Definitely. You have gone door-to-door canvassing on behalf of Northam. What issues are Virginia voters prioritizing in this race?
So healthcare is a huge thing to people. ACHA, wealth care, Trump care, Ryan care, whatever you want to call it, it's freaking people out a lot. Education, Betsy DeVos, and the potential impact she can have on national education policy. Trump is a big one. You know, a lot of people I talk to just say, get this fucking madman out of the White House. And I'm paraphrasing, yes. But that's also almost a direct quote. I added an F-bomb because that's fun for me.
We add F-bombs all the time on this show, so that's allowed. Yeah.
I know. We paraphrase a lot of people with F-bombs.
Yeah. One thing that that I've noticed that's actually really interesting is that a lot of people are still really disengaged from politics. And I get a lot of people who are really interested in talking and really want to talk about the race and policy and what's going on. But I get a lot of others that are like, it's Saturday afternoon. I don't fucking want to talk about politics. And I'm like, you know what? Neither do I, but it's not a choice.
But here we are.
This is not how I want to spend my weekend afternoons. I don't want to be bothering you at your doorstep while you're watching whatever's on TV. I'm an introvert. I don't love talking to strangers. It's just, this is the kind of thing we have to do right now. And what's kind of heartening is that if you can get them to talk to you, you can reach them, you can get them more engaged, you can at least get them to say, take this literature, look at it, take 5 minutes, get on the website, make your own choices. Your polling place is 10 feet away. There's a primary in 2 weeks. Get out there and vote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So kind of along that line, would you say that voters don't care about all this Russia stuff? Like, how do you feel about that?
I don't agree with that. I don't think it's most people's number one issue, but that's not to say they don't care about it. Like, it's an attack on our democracy. And it's amazing the way that people are capable of caring about more than one thing at a time.
What? Right? We're not like, multitasking?
I know.
Have men discovered that yet? Have we told men about multitasking?
I don't know. Somebody should. Sneak it into a Josh Barrow Twitter feed or something.
Yeah, it is interesting because, we keep hearing all over and over that voters don't care, but you're actually going door-to-door canvassing, so I'm curious to hear.
Yeah, I will say I don't have a lot of voters. We have walk sheets that we go out with, and there's a list of issues that we ask people about. Russia's not on there. We don't have a lot of people bring it up, but I don't think that means that people don't care. And I think that as people who are politically active, even if everyday voters don't care, we have to care, because you change policy and you attack the issues that people care about by winning elections, and you can't win elections if they're not free and fair.
Yeah,
you need democracy to win elections, and if there are foreign powers attacking our democracy, we can't do that.
We hard agree on that. And actually, I think I was thinking of your Twitter thread when I was talking about that in the past episode.
I went on a little rant.
I totally agree. Like, you know, maybe in elections, that's not the top priority of, you know, maybe you talk about healthcare more, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep talking about it. Like, I've heard people say that, oh, the Russia stuff will take care of itself. I'm like, that is how we ended up with Trump.
Right.
But no, we can't take that for granted. And I think we do need to keep beating that drum. So it's kind of interesting to hear that perspective from Virginia voters.
And then also, Virginia has gone blue in the last three presidential elections, and three of the last four governors have been Democrats. But you said that it's a pretty conservative...
In the state house,
it's pretty conservative. So would you characterize Virginia as a purple state, or has it really moved solidly blue?
It is continuously and consistently changing hues and getting bluer. Our state house is a tidge deceptive because we're gerrymandered half to death after 2010. I hesitate to call it solidly blue because of the state legislature and where it stands right now. But I think once we get to 2020 redistricting, we'll be there. I mean, the state's population grew nearly 5% between 2010 and 2015. The uptick is largely among the Democratic base, African-Americans, Asians, Hispanics, young people. So with the population continuing to grow so much in Northern Virginia, which is quite blue, it's really hard for me to imagine it going back. I mean, we do have some wealthy pockets in Northern Virginia that are still pretty red. And y'all talked about our county clerk race in Prince William a month or two ago, where we just out of nowhere swung that seat from red to blue. And that's an indicator of the rising energy among Virginia's Democrats. And I think we're going to continue to see that shift towards a more pure, beautiful blue.
A robin's egg.
Yes. Like the ocean.
Kind of along those lines, though, you know, speaking about the state house. So Republicans hold a 66-34 majority in the Virginia House of Delegates, but all 100 seats are up for election in November of this year, in 2017. So how much do you think Democrats can really close that gap in November?
I am so, so excited about this. I can't even express how excited I am about this. I don't know. Like, I wouldn't go so far as to say that we'll flip the state house. A 17 seat gain would be wow. But there are also 17 Republican seats in districts that Clinton won last year. So we are absolutely targeting those. We're fighting for those. And we don't usually fight for the state house. I mean, typically we have upwards of 40 Republican districts that go completely unchallenged in election years. And this year it's just 16. And the other super exciting part about that is that we have 61 women running, which is 30% of the field.
Yes.
And it's a huge jump. And half of the challengers running for Republican seats are women.
Woo-hoo.
So, great. Yeah, I think we're going to keep looking at Virginia as a bellwether for what's going to happen in the rest of the states that have their elections in 2018. And it's really, really exciting.
Yeah, we talked about the Virginia running on Virginia women running on one of our previous podcasts. Yep. And we're like fucking stoked on it. Which is funny. And it's funny you say, like, there's a bunch of districts that went for Hillary Clinton that, you know, are kind of vulnerable for Republicans. Because I just saw an article in the Washington Post today about how all these Southern California Republicans are like, who are like in vulnerable districts, they're like, we're not fucking worried. We're fine. I'm like, I am ready to come for these motherfuckers.
We are coming for you.
Yeah, that was Russia Rohrabacker, right?
Yeah. Yes, and he's
such a peach.
Such a peach.
Such a peach. Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah. So we're really excited. That's why. Yeah. We're just so stoked on Virginia.
Yeah.
I think what's really exciting about somebody like Rohrabacher and a lot of elected Republicans are like this. They get all their news from Fox News, just like the rest of their brethren. So they are living in an alternate reality, and I am very excited to just smack them upside the head with a big piece of real reality.
Yes.
In 2017. In 2018, in every possible race we can. If they don't feel vulnerable, you know what? We're going to sneak up behind them and we're going to catch them unawares. Just, and that's even better.
And like you said, we have caught some Republicans in very local elections totally unaware. They've been gobsmacked.
And even in these races that have been getting a lot of attention, like John Ossoff in Georgia 6th and Quist in Montana, even if we didn't win in Montana, but just the fact that we gave Republicans such a run for their money, like they've got the RNC like shaking in their boots.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of seats, you know, across the country that aren't as red as Kansas 4th or Montana at large that are, you know,
up
that with those margins, Democrats could have won. So yeah, I'm really, really stoked. Julie, man, this was such a really great and interesting conversation.
Seriously.
About Virginia politics. I feel like I learned a lot. Our last question is, as you know, we do a gratitude check every podcast, just to take stock of the good things that are still happening. So what's something that's happened recently that you're especially grateful for?
Well, one is, as we've been talking about Virginia this whole time, I am very grateful to live and be active in a state that has elections this year. There's only one other state, New Jersey, that has elections this year. And just being able to kind of try to harness this enthusiasm and hopefully ride this wave and bring this energy into something really constructive that can give hope to the country and hopefully provide some kind of blueprint for where Democrats can go next year is really, really exciting to me. And I'm very, very grateful for that.
Well, we're grateful for you for Seriously. All the work that you're doing. And just like
and your Twitter feed.
Yes.
I love it.
Yes. Which we will get into. Because we're like going to tell all you people to follow Julie.
Absolutely. So we just want to say thank you to Julie Baludis for joining us on Hellbent. You can follow her on Twitter, which you should absolutely do, at Resisterhood. Also, she'll be launching theresisterhood.com this month, where you'll be able to find consolidated call guides to engage your elected representatives in the latest GOP bullshit, as well as resources to get involved with your party locally, which is so awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure some of your stuff will show up on our action items.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. So thank you for joining us today. This is such a great conversation.
Thank you all so much for having me. It's been really, really great to be here.
All right. That was an awesome interview with Julie. Seriously. I feel like I learned so much, and it was so great to talk to her about Virginia politics.
She's so smart.
She's really smart.
And pretty.
And amazing.
And amazing.
Yeah. But let's move on to our gratitude check. So Devin, what are you grateful for today?
Okay. So the first thing I'm grateful for is Covfefe.
That's how I pronounce it too.
That's, we're so on the same page.
Like a lot of people, I think, pronounce it other ways, like Covfefe or whatever. I was like, Covfefe is how I see it in my head.
Exactly. Well, so first, this was kind of my first real experience with Twitter blowing the fuck up over something like this.
Right. I keep forgetting how new you are to Twitter.
Yeah.
Because you have so many like followers already.
I'm a big deal.
You're blowing up like Covfefe.
Covfefe. Also, I laughed for like a good hour after pursuing the hashtag.
Yeah. So Nick, my boyfriend, was on the couch watching like esports or some shit. And I was laughing my ass off. He was like, what are you laughing about? He is not a social media person in any regard. And I had to like, it was funny trying to explain it to him. Right. He was like, okay,
sure. So the responses were all so fucking good, but you know, as always, Hillary Clinton took, like, her tweet took the cake.
I love zero fucks Hillary Clinton.
Oh, she's my favorite.
She's my fave.
So Trump blathered on about crooked Hillary or some shit. I don't know. Who cares?
Dick waddy
things. And so she like quote tweeted him and said, "People in Covfefe houses shouldn't throw Covfefe."
It was great.
It was so great. Good. And I also loved hate that Sean Spicer tried to make it like a real thing.
This is so indicative of the Trump administration and like the emperor has no clothes.
I know. So he tried to make it a real thing, not a typo of in the middle of a coke-induced Twitter rage.
Allegedly.
Perpetrated in the middle of the night. He said, quote, "The president..."
and a small group of people know exactly what he meant, and I can't make this shit up.
I know, he was trying, and it was really funny watching the press room. They're like, what does it mean? Sean, what does it mean? He kept trying to call on someone else, and they're like, Sean, what?
What are you talking about?
Literally, like, the emperor has no clothes. Like,
yeah.
Every little thing that happens, he could have just said it was a typo, he went to bed,
he could have made a joke about it.
Well, and Trump did make a joke on his Twitter feed.
I know, it would have been,
but like, Sean Spicer was like, but he's like, nope, that was totally intentional.
It's a thing.
It's been really funny to see, like, people on the right try to spin it. Like,
I know.
Kayleigh McEnany or whatever.
Oh, yes.
She was like, this wasn't poll tested, it was authentic. Like, she basically was like, this is why Trump won. And I'm like, I believe it, because Republicans will defend any inane, absurd thing a Republican does till their death.
Well, right. And you can just see, like, the death behind Sean Spicer's eyes. Like, it's, yeah.
Yeah. But that was a beautiful moment in time.
It was beautiful.
We laugh through our pain.
Yes. Exactly. And that was just a moment where you could just laugh. Yeah. Pure laugh.
Let the air out.
Exactly. So the next thing was, there was this amazing PBS NewsHour article about West Virginia women taking a stand in one of the most, quote, Trumpian districts in America.
Yeah, I saw this.
Yeah, so 75% of this county that was being reported on voted for Trump, and it's very, like, forcefully, violently pro-Trump.
Mm.
And in response, a group of mostly women has formed, like, a huge anti-Trump resistance in the area. And I highly recommend the entire article, but kind of two quotes jump out at me. The first one is, quote, they talk about how hard this is, they being the women in mm-hmm. this movement, how their husbands got upset with them for appearing on the front page, how their neighbors hate their guts, and how the member of a local Republican Party group posted on Facebook that women who had participated in the Women's March had given over their dignity. So basically, just this sort of, like, resistance.
To their resistance.
To the resistance. And the fact that they're being degraded as women who are standing up for what they believe in, even by their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, like, a very powerful quote. And then the other quote was about one particular woman. Quote, an older woman speaks up next, her voice trembling a little. So I was sitting here earlier thinking, I never really had a voice before. She begins to cry, and another woman comes over and takes her hand. I was raised to be seen and not heard. Then I got married right out of high school, and it was the same thing. And I was abused for 14 years. You all gave me a voice again. The woman touches her chest. She is still crying. I'm so sorry.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That just gave me chills.
I know. So it's just, it's a beautiful piece about the power of women and the power of standing up for yourself when no one else will. And it's about defiance and subverting expectations. And, you know, it's about being a woman in America right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just so honored to be part of this movement in any small way. And mm-hmm. these women are making it happen. Like, I live in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
you know? Like,
yeah, it's not hard to express sort of liberal sentiment here.
Exactly.
We're pretty much surrounded by it.
Right, exactly. And so these women are making it happen, even in these very
deeply red, hostile
districts.
Yeah.
And I am so, so grateful for that.
Yeah, that's an awesome story.
Yeah,
and it's so like we always do, we have show notes
yes.
on the website, so we'll link to this article and everything else
yes.
we reference.
Right. So, okay, Sarah, what are you grateful for?
Yeah, so a couple things. The first thing I'm grateful for is the city of Baltimore.
Right.
The mayor is looking into the removal of Confederate monuments there.
Mm.
So they may, quote, follow in the footsteps of New Orleans in this regard. And if you remember, New Orleans had removed its fourth and final Confederate monument about a week ago when we
right.
referenced Mayor Mitch Landrieu and his speech, which
amazing
was amazing.
Speech.
So the mayor of Baltimore, Catherine Pugh, said that this, quote, the city does want to remove these, and they will be looking into doing so. They've actually been considering it for at least a few years now. Former Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake appointed a special commission in 2015 to study what to do with Baltimore's four Confederate-era monuments.
Right.
And then in the report, which was issued in August 2016, so last summer, the special commission recommended removing two of the four statues.
Interesting.
I don't know why they only said two of the four.
Huh.
Not clear to me. Also unclear how many, you know, Mayor Pugh may look to remove and when that might happen, but I'm glad to see more cities follow New Orleans' lead here.
Absolutely.
I think we need to keep doing this across America.
And it definitely does create a domino effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one city takes this step and it makes it easier for subsequent cities to do so.
Yep, definitely. The second thing I'm grateful for is the state of Illinois. So its
yes.
Republican governor will sign automatic voter registration after vetoing it last year.
Wow.
Yes.
What happened there?
I don't, you know, he had said some things about he doesn't think this does enough to, like, stamp out voter fraud, which we all know, it, like, voter fraud isn't a thing. But the measure this time passed Illinois House 115-0, like, completely unanimous. And so it'll head to the state Senate for consideration of the bill. So the Senate had previously passed a version of this legislation 48-0. So, like, people are pretty unanimous. So when it's the governor unanimous. When the governor vetoed it, people were like, what?
What the fuck is wrong with you?
So this is great because this legislation will automatically register people to vote when they interact with state driver's facilities and other state agencies.
This is great.
Yeah, so they'd be the 9th state to adopt automatic voter registration, and advocates estimate it could add over 1 million voters to the state's rolls. And Oregon was actually the first state to implement it, so they've seen a lot of success in it.
Wow.
And as we know, when voter turnout is up, and Democrats tend to win.
Yep.
And part of it is because of all these voter suppression laws. And so stuff like this, you know, as Joy Reid pointed out, the MSNBC host, she said, quote, automatic voter registration at age 18 would be the single most powerful anti-voter suppression tool, particularly if it was national.
Absolutely.
So this is a big part, I think, not only in making sure our society is as democratic as it should be, but in getting Democrats elected.
Absolutely. And also getting young people to vote. Because a lot of times they'll say, like, oh, like, I'm not registered, and it's too much work. And so if you're just automatically registered.
Yeah, we've talked about sort of our, you know, young people historically have not showed up to the ballot box in as great a number as is possible.
Right.
Like, we could really be a force. Part of it is voter suppression, but the other part of it is just not being engaged in the process.
Right.
So this could help that.
Exactly.
So I'm always grateful for things that make it easier for people to vote.
Yes.
The last thing I'm grateful for is a trio of New Jersey women.
All right.
So three women are making a long shot bid to flip New Jersey 39th from red to blue. So this is a sort of state elections. So the last time New Jersey's 39th district sent a Democratic representative to the state house, Ronald Reagan was president.
Wow.
So 4 decades later, now, an all-women ticket is looking to retake those legislative seats. So these women are Oakland Mayor Linda Schwager. So she'll be running for a state Senate seat, which incumbent Jerry Cardinale has won nearly a dozen times. So tough race.
Tough race.
I'm excited to see what she does with that. The other two women are Jani Chung and Annie Houseman. So they're seeking nominations from the Democrats to run for General Assembly. And I love Schwager's quote. She said, listen, I know it's a very Republican district. If we're going to do anything in the 39th, though, it's this year. We have so much momentum behind us, which I'm like, yes.
Yes, we do.
We just talked about this with Julie.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been local races in a bunch of different states that we have caught Republicans off guard.
Right.
And we have flipped blue. So yeah. I'm really excited about that. And it's funny because we also talked about, you know, Republicans in Southern California who don't feel worried, even though they're in vulnerable districts. And the same is kind of true. Like, there was a couple of Republican dickwads quoted in this article, and they were very dismissive of these Democratic women throwing their hats in the ring. So I'd love to see them be proven wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be just desserts.
Okay, Devin, let's keep the good vibes going. So let's get into our Maxine Waters update and Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. So first, what is our favorite Congresswoman Maxine Waters been up to?
Well, she went on AM Joy this past weekend.
They always have a moment of Maxine on Sunday. I love it.
I love it. And she just brought the motherfucking fire.
As
like
always.
She always says. So she said that Trump should be impeached. And, you know, you'd think it would get old, but it does not.
No, I love it.
I mean, she is one of only a few Congress members standing up and saying that this is what needs to be done.
Yeah, and it's really scary because there was a rep who went on the floor and called for Trump's impeachment, and he started to get, like, threats.
Yeah.
Like, lynching threats.
Right.
Which is disgusting. But, like, this is how tricky this topic can be
exactly.
for politicians, and it's disgusting, but, like, we are so proud of Maxine Waters for continuing to beat that drum.
Absolutely. And she also talked a little bit about Trump's financial ties to Russia, which we're starting to see more of, like, the FinCEN kind of investigation.
Right. But she's always saying, follow the money.
Follow the money. And so, you know, she said, quote, there's so many connections with the Kremlin and Putin demand investigation into what's going on.
Yeah.
And she also said about the mirror trading with Deutsche Bank back in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
She said,
Trump is very close to this.
Yeah.
And of course he is. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, and there have been stories that talked about how, you know, congressional investigators are getting financial records and data, and how, you know, we just talked about it in our Trumpland bullshit block with the Russia update about how there's potentially like derogatory information that is related to financial stuff.
Right.
So I think she's on the money there.
Yes.
And quite literally.
Quite literally on the money. She also threw some excellent shade without saying a word. She put up this image, and she it was an image of Trump bowing to the Saudi king, receiving like an award or some sort of like medal. And then she, next to it was Trump's past tweets disparaging Obama for doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, hashtag Trump tweet for everything.
Did she say that?
No, she didn't.
But it's so true. There's always some past Trump tweet for a future Trump hypocrisy.
It's so...
Yeah. Love Maxine. She's always doing the most. Okay, so let's get into our Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. And we have a couple of runner-ups. So the first one is a 9-year-old girl named Wendy, who one of our listeners pointed to. She basically dressed down her state senators about the SB4 bill that tries to essentially gut the idea of sanctuary cities.
Which is still a moving target that I still don't think...
You mean the idea of
the sanctuary?
We've talked about that before, like that it's a sanctuary city. There's still issues with it that aren't totally in line with what it's trying to do.
Yeah.
So this protest was actually one of our action items in the last podcast, and it became subject of national news when a Texas Republican he called ICE on those protesters and threatened to shoot a colleague.
Right.
Like, what?
Yeah.
Texas, what is happening?
Yeah, what are you doing over there?
And so that is like what's scary. You know, a lot of people, that's why sometimes, you know, they won't go to protest because they're afraid for themselves. Like,
it is.
In this case, they called ICE, you know, and like they're very clearly trying to intimidate people who would be affected by this, which is disgusting. And then threatening to shoot a colleague is just like the shit, like topping on the shit cake.
Like, I don't know. Like, what do you even do with that?
Yeah. But I loved, you know, Wendy, she was so strong. She said, quote, "You should be ashamed of yourselves. It is ridiculous for a 9-year-old girl to be here fighting for her family because of this hateful law." And protesters are going to fight this law in court, but, you know, we hope that senators and the governor are ashamed of themselves. Shame is not something that really crosses the mind for Republicans.
No, that's true.
So that might be a pipe dream. but not only because this law is disgusting, it's very much, in essence, show me your papers.
Right.
But because a 9-year-old has enough sense to show up and yell at them about it.
I mean,
it's just, and it reminds me also of those, like, 8th graders we talked about. Like, kids have more, more moral, you know,
high ground
than elected reps.
Yeah, because they're like, fuck you, Paul Ryan.
Yeah, fuck you. Yeah. Fuck all you Republicans.
Yeah, like we're not doing this.
Yeah, so she's an honorable mention. Who's our next honorable mention?
Okay, Devin? So the next one is a dad from the Seattle Public School District, Jeffrey Law. He raised more than $40,000 to pay off all of the student lunch debt in his district, as well as two other nearby districts. Yeah. He read an article about school lunch shaming, which is where schools will make kids wear wristbands or have different food, you know, just
if there's debt with their lunch.
Yeah. Or they're denied food.
Oh, wow.
Which I just can't.
Not feeding kids.
I don't understand.
Shaming kids.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand it, especially when they don't have any control over it.
Like, mm-hmm.
I can't. But anyway, he was very disgusted with this idea. And so I guess Seattle Public School District does not engage in lunch shaming or debt shaming, but he didn't want this to become an issue.
Right.
So his next thing is he wants to end school lunch shaming. The debt at his children's school was less than $100, and the price to erase lunch debt for the entire district was $20,000.
Oh, wow. But he raised $40,000?
He raised $40,000, and so now he's aiming to erase lunch debt from the entire state.
Wow.
And he wants to create a fund to continuously pay off.
So this story is awesome.
It is.
Like, it's so great to see someone organized in this way. I do think it points to, like, the inadequacy of our programs.
Absolutely.
And we're seeing the Trump administration absolutely gut these kind of things.
Right.
But hats off to Jeffrey Law for doing this.
Yeah.
Because this is so important.
It is so important. And it just really, I don't understand how not feeding children can be so politically popular.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what do you do for fun? Kick puppies? Like, come on.
That is Paul Ryan's idea of fun.
I know.
It's like, you know, shaming poor people.
Yeah, it's horrible.
But our winner actually is one of our very own listeners, Lauren Whitehead. She won a seat on her city council in a special election in Solon, Iowa. So Lauren actually helped start Iowa's statewide indivisible chapter, and she defeated the incumbent, Dale Snipes, 64% to 36%. And I believe within the city, Hillary Clinton got less than 50% of the vote.
Wow, so that's awesome. Amazing. Yeah. So she was motivated to run after the results this November. She said, quote, "I thought about running for city council for a long time, but after the 2016 general election, I felt like that would be part of my future activism in Iowa. And it seemed like a good place to start."
Yeah, so she's among many women who are like, you know, who were either thinking about running or never thought about running, who, you know, this election was a kickstart, and she ran and she won. And, you know, it's starting to get a little bit of a national attention too. Charles Pierce, who's a political writer for Esquire, tweeted this story. He said, "I can't tell you how happy this story makes me," which, like, hard same.
Hard same.
This is so awesome. We're so excited for Lauren. Like, it's really amazing to see smart, motivated women running, and like hellions.
Hellions. Like, hellions are running.
Yeah. I think one of our listeners, Britton, had a great hashtag. It was like, "Get hellions elected."
Or yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I might be doing that wrong, but like get hellions elected. I love it. So yeah, local politics is sexy.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Go forth, change the world, and just like Leslie Knope it the fuck up.
Leslie Knope it the fuck up. Okay, Sarah, so last but not least, let's talk about some action items, some things that our listeners can do after they're done listening.
Yeah, so the first thing that caught our attention was Swing Left. So they're looking for hosts for, quote, Call Your Oss Off phone making parties, which I just love the name. They had Resist with Quist, now it's Call Your Oss Off.
Oh, so good.
So yeah, I did phone banking for Rob Quist. So right now they're in the like beginning stages of organizing it, so they need hosts. So if you go to swingleft.org/special-election-house-parties to do so if you want to host. And like that election is going to be close. And I think we could actually pull it out. So,
I think we might be able to.
I think we might be able to, but it's going to take some work in the final stretch. So mm-hmm. if you're interested in hosting a phone baking party, do so on Swing Left. Again, we do show notes. So if you didn't catch that website, we'll put it on hellbentpodcast.com. On a related note, early voting has started for the Georgia 6th special election. So make sure to vote if you live in that district, or if you have friends or family there, remind them too.
Absolutely. And also a reminder to wear orange tomorrow, June 2nd, for National Gun Violence Awareness Day. So one of our previous guests, Shannon Watts, founded Moms Demand Action, and they're doing this big push for everyone to wear orange to signify that they are against gun violence.
Yep. Lastly, there is a March for Truth this Saturday in over 135 cities across the country. So the aim of the march is to call for an independent commission to investigate Russia and for Congress to compel Trump to release his tax returns. So if you go to marchfortruth.info/find-a, we're gonna put it on our, so it's marchfortruth.info/find-a-local-march. That's that way you can find one near you. I'll be going to the one in LA.
I will also be going to the one in LA.
And we'll take lots of pictures, and we would love to see pictures of your signs and all that good stuff.
Absolutely. So I think that does it for us.
I know. Lots of good action items.
Yes.
And a packed show. We had such a great conversation with Julie. We so really, great. Really enjoyed it. And always so much stuff happening in Trump land. But thank you for listening. We will see you on Patreon or back on Monday.
For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we've discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. You can follow Devin on Twitter at DevinHandy, and you can follow Sarah on Twitter at Sarah Lerner.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent. and there are lots of other fun rewards for higher levels of patronage, including a monthly Skype session with Devin and Sarah.
And for that one, drinking is optional.
Optional.
Quote unquote.